everyone, and welcome to the show, Alternative Health and Wellness. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and we are live on Sedona Talk Radio, Blog Talk Radio, and we are also archived on iTunes. It's a pleasure to have you with us this evening. It is going to be a beautiful fall, they say. Things are starting to turn, the leaves are starting to change, and there hasn't really been much of a drought. There's been a lot of rain, so all of the Northeast will probably be having a lot of colors. So if you're in those areas, I'll bet you're having a great time this year. So also today we're going to be talking about is the fall time of your life, what we call it the ending season, or maybe that season just before that. We've done many shows before on end of life or what to do about that or last wishes, what to be able to do when you're reaching over 50. We've had many shows on over 60. We've done a lot of things with different topics that you would be facing that maybe you say, oh my gosh, I never thought of that, and all of a sudden it hits you in the face. Well, we always talk about what happens. I'm an alternative healthcare practitioner. Most of the patients and clients that come to me are ones that say, my doctor said he can't help me anymore. I really need you to fix me. I really need a miracle, and I really need it to be now. And a lot of times, really the best thing that we're able to help them with is being able to set up and put things into place to be able so that they would enjoy their last days, weeks, months, or even years or so. Because we do the best we can with our bodies, and there are times when it's going to run out. I mean, that's just an inevitable thing. And sometimes when we think we are always going to be a miracle, yes, we are going to be a miracle, and we can expect them. There are times when we're disappointed, and that just isn't on the table for us. So tonight we're going to be talking about the fall time of our life, the time where changes occur, where what do we do then? We're going to be talking about hospice, death and dying, and being able to know when to be able to ask for help, when you won't be able to get help, when you will be able to get help, and what does hospice even mean? You know, I've worked with many clients at end of life, and we've spoken about hospice, and every single one had a very different story from the other. No one is the same. So all of these systems are in place, and they're all there. It's just when you access them, how you access their services, if you're able to even feel comfortable in being able to have this work for you. And some people even get better. So there's miracles and there's hope all the way around. My guest this evening is Fran Smith. She's the co-author of Changing the Way We Die, Compassionate End-of-Life Care in the Hospice Movement. She'll be describing all of these different definitions for us that we should be thinking about in terms and then services, and also a lot of stories that are in her book. So, Fran, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So, don't you think that this term of hospice can be so different? You could have 1,000 people, and it'll be different for everyone.
Yeah, hospice is really a misunderstood term. And I'd like to say I love the way you opened the program by talking about the beauty of fall and relating it to this topic. You know, one of the ideas in our book is that this whole subject and hospice, it doesn't have to be a depressing topic. It can actually be quite inspiring when we all embrace the fact that this is part of life. You know, dying is not an if, but a when. And when we get our brains around that and kind of make plans for that, it really changes the whole dynamic, not only about how we die, but also about how we live life. So I love the way you opened the program. But yeah, there are a lot of myths and misconceptions about what hospice is and what hospice isn't. Hospice is basically a philosophy of care, a philosophy of the compassionate and holistic care of patients who have a life expectancy of 6 months. It's not a place. Many people think hospice is a place you go to die. And hospice, there are inpatient hospice units. There are hospice wings in nursing homes and hospitals. But most hospice care is provided to patients in their own homes. And really, that's where most people say they want to die, in the comfort of their own homes.
Absolutely. You know, Fran, we're getting a tiny drop of feedback on your sound.
Okay.
So just pull your phone like maybe away from you for a little bit more and see if it's better.
Okay, how does this sound?
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
Sorry about that.
And you know what? Yeah, and I think a lot of times, too, we think about hospice when I say that to people. They're like, oh, you mean I'm going to die? And I think I've even had clients where we sat down and said, okay, but did I say today? And they're like, no. I said, okay, so then what do you want to do today? And I just totally took it out of there in 5 seconds flat. That might have been 2 seconds. And once you do that, that just changes the energy around the whole subject because they're saying, I'm not going to today, but, oh, I know I'm going to. So, oh, you know what I want to do today is, and they'll tell you.
Exactly.
You know
we found that again and again families told us they wished they'd known about hospice sooner. They wished they'd considered the option earlier. And, you know, and really, you know, exactly as you say, when people perceive it as a death sentence, you know, mm-hmm. of course it's going to be something that you want to put off and put off and put off. But mm-hmm. hospice offers such an array of services, and people who are able to get access to those services earlier in the, you know, earlier in the disease process while they're still, you know, strong enough to live life, to enjoy life, to be with their families, to do whatever's meaningful to them, to pray, to, you know, have spiritual connections, to have reconciliations with people, whatever it is, you know, hospice can really facilitate that and enable that for people.
I think pretty much the biggest thing that I think people fear is I won't get everything in time before I do die. So knowing that you might be at that point and having the available services or even having anything available at all is really a great gift for many people because they can say, oh, my goodness, you know, I didn't die in my sleep last night, so I have tomorrow. I have another 24 hours or whatever it might be. And to take every single minute and really value that is so vitally important, don't you think?
Yes. You know, we open the book with a story about a man who named Rusty Hammer, who was diagnosed with leukemia, terrible leukemia, at the age of 50. And he spent years, almost five years, in just hellacious treatment. He had 250 medications that he received. He had 350
yeah.
blood transfusions, stem cell transplant, hundreds of nights in 6 different hospitals. And he considered himself a fighter. And he was appalled when somebody a friend first said, you know, do you want to think about hospice? And he met with the hospice social worker, you know, just to hear what it was all about. He really didn't intend to take that route. And the social worker said, what do you want to do with the rest of your life?
Mm-hmm.
And it totally changed the equation for Rusty.
Yeah.
You know, and he thought about what he wanted to do. It wasn't go back to the hospital, you know, week after week after week. It wasn't have another stem cell transplant or another blood transfusion. It was spending time with his kids, spending time with his wife, hanging out with friends. He thought he might even want to write a book about cancer to help other people deal with it. And in the 6 months he was on hospice care, he did all of those things.
Right. And, you know, that is so very important, I think, because once you can take the fear out of the equation, it'll change your outlook, it'll change your life. And you really need to be firm in that, though, changing the fear of it, because once you do, others that are coming around you will have their own fear, and you kind of like want to say, y'all keep it. You know, I'm ultra-vultured my fear. Don't bring any of your fear to me. We're going to enjoy it. We're not going to sit here and that. And I think I've even heard of so many people that have gone into, you know, had hospice services and even palliative care therapies, and what they really came out of was that they had so much empowerment in themselves that they did let go of that fear, and that fear had encompassed so many different things in their life through many years that all of a sudden that those are ones that are called the miracles, because then they walk out of there. You know, they have years and years, or something just changes totally. And then we always talk about the power of energy medicine on this show, and I think really that's a good comparison of that.
Yes, you know, I have to agree with that. You know, when the fear is what really makes this so hard for so many people. You know, hospice, at its best, a good hospice program can can take care of the physical symptoms. You know, there's really good palliative medicine, you know, relief, pain relief, all that kind of stuff. Hospice care can provide the social support, social worker help with practical kinds of issues, and you know, and the psychological and spiritual support. One of the great insights of the early hospice movement was to realize that suffering at the end of life wasn't only a physical thing, you know, that it was that there were spiritual and psychological and emotional dimensions to suffering, and that those, you know, that you really had to address all of them in order to relieve suffering. And fear is certainly part of that.
But I think so, too. It all comes along in the history when you look at it, because nowadays, if someone is ill or if something happens, it's always a long-distance call to find a relative somewhere that you can talk to. You know, it's not like it's your whole family around the corner that's coming over to take care of you and help you and support you and get you everything you need and give you all that love, care, and compassion that you really need at that time. It's called, oh, I'm too busy, just call me when the event happens, or, oh, my gosh, do I really need to come now? I've got kids or a husband or a job or whatever the story is. And, I mean, I think a life has gotten way too complicated to be able to handle this type and this time of life for a lot of people. So a lot of people are dying alone now. I know myself, I lived in this apartment, and the lady across the way, I saw her go in when we first moved in, and she looked really frail and everything. And I said, oh, my gosh, you know, I haven't seen her out. It's 6 months. It's 9 months. It's a year. Still haven't seen her out. One day, I saw somebody cleaning out her apartment. She had died in her apartment by herself. And I, you know, and this whole time I kept saying, I'm going to go see if she's okay. I'm going to go see if she's okay. And my husband kept saying, don't stick your nose anywhere. It doesn't belong, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm like, you know, really, it had me so ticked off, I will never do that again. Because you know what? If I'm going to go see somebody, I don't care who they are, I'm going to go do it. Because that woman did die alone. And that, and you know, that's so out there if you just look at it. If you just open your eyes to it, you know, with this conversation we have tonight, it's just saying, oh, I didn't think of that. I don't know what that's about. I don't know. And then give all these excuses and reasons. But I will almost guarantee you, if you listen to the show full through for the hour or parts of it, tomorrow, the next day, or by the end of the week, somebody somewhere is going to say something that we've talked about on this show.
Well, and you're making a great point, because you know, even hospice care, even when, you know, when it's provided at home, it's not 24/7 care.
Right.
The hospice people come in, but really, they, you know, they're there to support the family. You know, it's a lot of responsibility is on families, and so, you know, really as a society, you know, we all have to, while we have to think about what are the choices we want at the end of life. Do we want, you know, do we want to die in an intensive care unit in a hospital, or do we want to die at home? Do we want to, you know, how do we want this to be? We also really have to figure out, what am I willing to do to be there for the people I love, you know, and support their choices. You know, survey after survey shows that most Americans want to die at home, but there are also surveys that show most Americans are terrified that somebody they love is going to want to die at home. You know, it's a huge responsibility. And,
right.
And you know, so you're bringing up a great point.
You know, and also, too, you know, not everybody's families are hunky-dory, you know. I mean, if you say you want to die at home, you know, do you really want some of those people, those relatives coming to see you? It's sort of like, let me die in the hospital and drug me up and forget about it, because I don't want to see those people. You know, and I've had a lot of these conversations with people. They're like, I don't want them anywhere near me, you know. And there's some that just can't wait for them to come. But there's others that have issues all through their decades of their life that they've never dealt with. And those will go with them to the grave, and many people take them with them. But also, too, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's plays a huge, I would say, hands down, a large, large portion of this. Because any type of mind altering, that is something else when it gets to be that time of life. I mean, just today I was speaking with another friend. She was helping a person who had has cancer and started to show signs of dementia, and then, you know, here come the drugs, here come, oh, the antidepressants and this and that and the other and everything. And don't you know, all of a sudden the hospice nurse that comes in says, oh, well, I think we need to get elder abuse in here. Like, what? Because they're listening to the person that has dementia, and the person that has dementia is not getting the story straight. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that shows it forward, and you're just going, oh, my word. And then that's another such assault on that client again, you know,
mm-hmm.
because that removes people who are actually helping out or not helping out. And it's not elder abuse. It's just that it's just the frame of time. It's just the frame of time has so many nooks and crannies and corners and shakes that you just, like I just said in the beginning of the show, if you've got 1,000 people, line them all up, everyone's going to have a totally different story.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and Alzheimer's and dementia patients are, you know, increasingly, they are, you know, who the people who are cared for in hospice care. When hospice started out,
mm-hmm.
it was primarily cancer patients, and many
mm-hmm.
people will think that's what hospice is all about, is cancer. But cancer patients actually represent, you know, less than half of all hospice patients. And, you know,
right.
really increasingly it's people with dementia, chronic congestive heart failure, you know, really all the things that people die of in this country.
Right. And then they're just showing up to the person's house, you know, 1-2 days a week. What are they to do, you know? So really, you know, the type of care and the transition and then who is or isn't helping, it really gets to be kind of frustrating then. You know, you always talk about those stories, and that story is that you just go, I don't know. And I know over the decades, I mean, I'm a Catholic, and you know, you wrote in your book about the doctor had said about with the nuns, oh gosh, where did it say it? I had written it down. Oh. One of your pages you had said about, the nuns would help out at hospice in the beginning. And that definitely is true because, you know, I can remember the Immaculate Heart of Mary was the nun service that had started up in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
And they always were the ones that would come and take care of those that weren't able to take care of themselves, you know, at the end of life. And you think about it and you go, oh, my goodness, you know, but they don't even have nuns anymore, you know. So all that caring and nurturing that was given a long time ago, it just isn't even here anymore.
Well, you know, the earliest hospices were Christian organizations, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of grew out of this, you know, what you're describing, you know, basically nuns caring for people who, you know, nobody else would care for. And,
right.
You know, and kind of doing it in the name of salvation, you know.
Right.
The hospice movement grew out of that. But really, you know, there are a lot of hospice programs across the country, you know, the secular programs. I mean, they offer spiritual care, but they're not, you know, they don't come out, they're not, you know, run by nuns, but that deliver, you know, the most exquisite care,
mm-hmm.
you know, the kind of care you're describing. And
right.
you know, not to say every hospice program does that or every person who comes to a hospice program gets that kind of service, but there's really
correct.
There, you know, and we were just, in writing the book, we're so blown away by just the, you know, the dedication, the time, you know, doctors who visit patients at home and spend an hour or an hour and a half just talking, looking a patient in the eye, talking to a patient, you know, the kind of care you never really see in a hospital, you know, where everybody's
mm-hmm.
running around and busy. So you know, I know lots has changed since the days of nuns caring for people. There's still so many instances of, you know, beautiful, really, for, you know, lack of a better word, beautiful care that's given.
And I think you have to really seek it out, and you really have to have an advocate or a person that stands by you or supports you, like, even if it's just one person. Because I live here in the Deep South, and let me tell you, I see a lot of people. My husband works with the burial insurance, and when he goes to the houses, he says these people are just sitting in their chair at the front door. They don't even eat, or they aren't taken care of, and they don't have AC, and they don't have any help. And you just want to go, my goodness, where is humanity, you know? And where can it be? So when we define hospice, we're defining it as a blanket term, and a blanket service is thereunder. But how you get that it can be so varied. It'll depend upon what you're able to stand up and receive and say or ask for, what your caregiver, you know, someone that's helping you, your advocate or your support person is able to support you in getting, and also the education of your physician and the services in your area, because they do vary from state to state and city to city and area to area. Because it is a large, large part. I mean, if you go to an older city, that doctor in town, he may have most all of his patients, you know, at 60 and over. That may just be his practice. And he may be overwhelmed or not overwhelmed. He may have the most fabulous hospice setup that there is. But also, too, I think we're starting to see an increasing number of people. When hospice works or doesn't work, we see a lot of people put into nursing homes and rehabs. I'm sure you may have seen that. You know, after a heart attack, you don't even come home anymore. You just go into rehab. And, you know, depending on your support systems and where they're at.
Right. And, you know, and there are hospice wings in nursing homes. But, you know, sometimes co-author Sheila Hamill, and we write about this in the book. Her father, both of us came to this book through the deaths of our fathers. Both of our fathers died after a long declines. My father died in the hospital, did not have hospice care. Sheila's father had been in a nursing home, but he went on to hospice care and died under hospice care. And you know, she writes in the book about just the difference that made. I mean, even though he was in the same building, you know, but he was under the care of a different group of professionals, and
mm-hmm.
the expectations and the were different. The conversations were different. So, you know, he didn't have to get up and go to occupational therapy and all the stuff that he really didn't want to be doing anymore anyway, and that wasn't getting him, you know, any better.
Right.
And there were now professionals on the scene who could really talk with the family about what to expect. They were available 24/7 by phone if the family had any questions, practical questions, or just needed to talk. So just really everything changed when, you know, even though he was still in the nursing home, when he was switched onto the hospice service. And, you know, she's always said it was like a shroud of anxiety lifted. You know, there was like the calming presence of the hospice professionals.
I think I used to do a lot of volunteer work with the hospice for, I think, a few years before medical school. And it is a much different, as you've said, atmosphere, because there isn't that rush, we got to get this done, we got to get that done, we're getting billed by this insurance and that insurance, and the clock is ticking, so we have to make sure we have all parameters so we're able to be paid. You know, that's what happens when you're still in, quote, care, active care. So when you're into palliative care and hospice, it totally shifts, because then you're given a blanket amount of time, and you're then all of those other things, like you said, with occupational therapy, physical therapy, all this excess testing, all of this imaging and everything else, a lot of that falls away. And it just, you're just left to rest. You're just left at peace. And you say, my goodness, finally, all of that is done. You know, that phase has ended. And that relief just takes a lot of, you know, anxiety, as you've said, away from family members, but also the patient themselves.
Right. And, you know, often patients actually do better, at least for a while. In the
mm-hmm.
book, we write about a woman who had congestive heart failure and a number of other problems, and she was in her 90s, and she went on to hospice care and, you know, and had dementia, seemed to have dementia, you know, was not alert a lot of the time.
Right.
And she went on to hospice care, and the expectation was, you know, death was imminent. And she lived 14 months on hospice care.
Yeah.
And a doctor, you know, who an expert in palliative medicine, came in and took control of her whole case and looked at, you know, this long list of medications she was getting,
mm-hmm.
simplified that list, and immediately the woman was more alert and ambulatory, because she wasn't just getting all of these medicines that had all of these different side effects. And
yeah, you know, I always tell them, you know, make sure the first call you make at that point is going to be to palliative care and or to a geriatric physician, because that list of drugs that you've had up to that time has not been looked at by several people, even though they say, I mean, we will all say, It's great to have electronic medical records, so we all know what everybody is doing and everything's on the thing. Uh-huh, sure. And then I remember myself as a patient sitting down. A doctor had come in to give me results on a test, and all she had was a piece of paper in her hand. She said, here's the results of your test, and this is what we're going to do. I said, did you read my chart? She says, no, I'm only here to give you the results of your test. I said, well, you know what? You can go out and you can go around and read my chart, and I'll be back in another time. And I left. Because we have to realize that not everybody can do everything for everybody, but you're the only one that can speak up for yourself, and that's so vitally important. And when you take away a lot of these medications, or you give somebody the power to be able to speak for themselves or care for themselves or say what they think, a lot more power comes back to a lot of these people.
Right, and even when you just start treating people like people and not like mm-hmm. their disease, you know,
mm-hmm.
how they relate to themselves and to the world.
Yeah, and, you know, doctors are only as good as they're able to be. We forget that they're human beings first, you know. Being a doctor means a degree. That means they went to school. Everybody went to school for a different profession, I always tell them. We had these little conversations. I says, we're all the same. Oh, no, we're not. Yes, we are. But, you know, we also talk about, too, about the kindness of the human heart. I think a lot of times we talk about compassion and empathy, and that's so important in the hospice system. But I think also, too, when you talk about working with the family members, because you're not only there just in the beginning, you're also there after the event. But that's so important because if you have formed a bond and a connection, they're already laying open their hearts to you so that you would be able to say, I understand, I can sit with you, I can be with you, I can listen to you. How many people do you ever listen to and actually hear anymore? Not many people. So, but this situation does allow that, right?
Absolutely. The founder of the first hospice in the United States, a nurse named Florence Wald in Connecticut, she used to say, listening is an essential act of care, you know, and that's really the hospice philosophy. And, you know, and you're right, it's not just for the patient, but also for the family. And the services continue until at least a year after the death of a loved one. So bereavement services, under Medicare regulations, hospices are required to offer bereavement services. And that can vary. Exactly how hospices do that, you know, can vary from program to program. But, you know, at its best, we have a couple of chapters about a bereavement group of spouses, you know, a group of people who had all lost long-term spouses and, you know, came to this group just, you know, lost, bereft, and nobody really wanted to come. You know, every one of them felt, you know, I'm not a group person,
right.
I don't want to hear other people's problems, you know, all that kind of thing. But, and they ended up
mm-hmm.
coming to this group because they were so desperate, you know. The deaths had happened, their friends, you know, were sort of ready for them to move on from the grief, you know, get over it. And, you know, and they came to this group, and these, you know, they had a very skilled facilitator, but just being together, you know, in that setting with a skilled facilitator, an amazing bond formed. And actually, as we write in the book, out of this group, three couples came out of the group. But, you know, it was really, really kind of extraordinary, and it's one of the services that is kind of least appreciated or understood, that hospices, you know, hospice programs are not just for patients, but offer support and bereavement services to family members.
And there's a lot of changes now to Medicare. I mean, goodness gracious, just wait for the wind to blow and you'll find another one. But, you know, but we always look at the thing, how much is Medicare going to cover? How much is your Part B or this or the other going to cover? Or if you have Medicaid or not or private insurance. And right now I think it is still at 6 months. And they say you can reapply, but I will tell you it is an uphill battle to reapply. And it's sometimes a battle to even get that first 6 months from a physician. Because to be able to say, okay, I've done everything I can, the physician is really in a position where he really has to be sure he has dotted all his T's and his eyes and being able to make sure that he has done everything for that patient. Because when he says signs on for hospice, many of them will turn that chart over then to a different type of physician or a different practice that would be taking care of that person. Many times I've found, and I'm sure it's not the norm, is that that longtime physician is no longer the physician of care, or the physician that may have taken them all through their cancer is no longer the physician of care, or the surgeon that they've been seeing or the radiologist they've been seeing for a year or 2 years, which has really seemed to gotten closer to their heart, is no longer the physician of care, and that really puts them in a place, you know, at that moment of making that decision, hospice or not.
Yes, you know, that is definitely a barrier because, as you say, you know, when you patient is referred for hospice services, you know, they then enter the care of the hospice physician. And it can be very hard for patients to mm-hmm. you know, let go of a long-time physician and, you know, the person that they've been in treatment with or, you know, even a family physician that they've known forever. You know, on the other hand, palliative medicine is a specialty just like any other kind of specialty. So, you know, you wouldn't want to hang on to your family physician when you needed radiation on, you know, oncology, you know, radiation mm-hmm. for your cancer. You'd want an expert radiation oncologist. And, you know, when you enter hospice care, you know, really what patients need is that kind of expertise.
Yeah. And I think that that's really a transition, a transference of power, because you've given the power over to those doctors to care for you all along. Everybody gives up their power at some point, right? And you give it to that physician, and you're standing there in their office saying, I want my power back because I have to give it to somebody else now. And how difficult that is when you really want to start owning that power for yourself, and you're saying, this is the last time I'm giving it away. And that's a very hardcore thing. That will almost get you right in your gut right then and there.
Well, you know, hospice, you know, and I always say hospice at its best because, you know, a really good hospice mm-hmm. program and a really good hospice physician, that's what they do. You know, they are all about letting the patients and the families have the power, and the care
yeah.
is, you know, is determined by patients and by families. And it's not the doctor coming in and saying, you know, you need this, you need that. But as I said, you know, we saw doctors coming in and, you know, and sitting with a patient for an hour or so, you know, on every visit to just hear mm-hmm. where they're at, hear their concerns, you know, talk about the choices available and let patients, you know, patients who, you know, who are competent to make the decisions, make their own decisions
mm-hmm.
about what they want. You know, if patients want to eat, they eat. If patients don't want to eat, they don't have to eat. You know, if families are trying to
right.
shut down food down the patients, you know, urge
mm-hmm.
the patient to eat. You know, a good hospice nurse and good hospice physician will, you know, will kindly and gently suggest to a family, let that person be. You know, they'll eat when they want to. They won't eat if they don't want to. You know, they're not dying because they're not eating. You know, they're not eating because they're dying, kind of thing.
Right. But also, too, I think that's where the point, again, we made in the beginning is about compassion, empathy, and grace and being able to walk in and say, how can I help you? I think it, just that phrase, if you had just mentioned that right in the beginning of that transition time or that transmission when you're transference of power, you say, how can I help you? I think that just melts a lot of people, and they're like, oh, my goodness, I'm going to tell you how you could help me. And then if you're there to listen, that's when really a lot of pathways can open up.
Yeah, well, you know, we write about exactly that phrase in a chapter. We write about the spiritual care that hospice provides. You know, some people hear about hospice spiritual care and they think, oh, God, you know, I'm not a God person and I want no part of this, you know.
Right.
And really, the spiritual care that hospice provides is the philosophy is really, you know, it's all about a reverence for life and meeting patients where they're at. So, you know, if it's something that a patient wants nothing to do with, then it's offered and that's kind of the end of it. But patients, even patients who, you know, who have not been church going or considered themselves religious, you know, while they were well, you know, really benefit from the support of somebody who, you know, really comes from a spiritual place and doesn't have an agenda for the patient, you know, and enters the room, and that, you know, that's what we write about, you know, enters the room and asks, how can I help you? It's that simple.
Yeah. I think that just opens up so many doors, you know, to be able to say that. And I think, too, to not overwhelm the patient and say, we need to make all these decisions. It's sort of like, you know, what is really important that day is what's important that day. And not, oh, my gosh, we have to go to your house and split everything up. I'm going to bring you a list of what's in your house, and are we going to split it up today? But if we turn around and say to the people, we have this lovely vase. Would you like me to bring it into you? You know, and a lot of people react much better to things like that. I know I had had one client, and they had done that same thing. But then there was another where the hospice nurse said, oh, my goodness, she's not laughing, she's not feeling good, she might need more medications. And for people to understand who the people really are and, you know, to say, I just wanted something that meant some value to me, or I'm missing a relative that isn't here yet, or whatever that is. But sometimes the hospice person is a good person to talk to, too, because you can hear those things that maybe they don't want to always tell other family members, too.
Right. You know, and even their own clergy person, you
yeah.
know, often, you know, we heard this again and again, and we write about this, but, you know, a hospice chaplain or spiritual care provider will come in and, you know, we'll hear things and be told things that really the person could not tell their own, you know, priest or rabbi or, you know,
yeah.
someone they have a long-term relationship. You know, patients want to protect the people they love, and that can include their clergy.
And it's just somebody to be able to listen to them. I mean, a lot of fears, too, you know, about when I close my eyes, what's going to happen, you know? Sometimes people have so many different viewpoints of that you can't really dismay them all, but you have to just say, I don't know. All I know is that you will be fine and you will be whatever that person is seeking. You know the words when that event or time comes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, I couldn't agree more.
Don't you think, too, though, that there's a lot of other barriers to good hospice care? And one, I think, is money, insurance coverage, poverty. The type of insurance you have is so limiting anymore to anything. And also, you know, I think there's another barrier is family support. You know, a lot of people just don't even have it anymore.
Yeah, there are quite a few barriers to care, and one is, you know, as you say, family support. And, you know, as we were talking about earlier, especially if you want hospice care at home, you know, there need to be people around who can provide the bulk of the care for you and can be supported by the hospice team, because the hospice team won't be there every day and won't be there 24 hours a day. And the, you know, insurance is kind of a more complicated question. Medicare covers hospice care for patients who have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. And, you know, and people get recertified, although, as you pointed out earlier, that's getting harder and harder to do. But if they live longer, that, you know, people can often get recertified. And most private insurance companies follow the Medicare template on that. One of the biggest barriers we found is that under Medicare and Medicaid and most private insurance plans, patients have to choose, in order to enroll in hospice, patients have to agree to forego treatment for their primary illness. So,
right.
You know, if you are a cancer patient and you've been getting chemotherapy or, you know, radiation, and you just, you know, you're kind of at the point where you're thinking, you know, hospice support would be a really great thing for you and your family. You know, you have to stop that. So it makes people feel like they're giving up hope. And the reason that Medicare requires that is because of costs. You know, back when Medicare started covering hospice, and, you know, really hasn't changed since then, there was this idea that, well, if everybody got, you know, all kinds of treatment and they got hospice care, it was just going to be really expensive. One of the large insurance companies has actually kind of tested that. They eliminated this either-or kind of thing, and they said, okay, you know, if you want to continue treatment, you can continue treatment, and you can enroll in hospice if that's what you want. You know, they wanted to see what would happen, and it turned out a lot more people enrolled in hospice care, but they didn't pursue all of the treatment. You know, it just, they wanted the choice, but they actually didn't, you know, once they had good hospice care, they didn't really want to be running back and forth to the hospital and getting, you know, heavy-duty drugs and heavy-duty treatments. And so it really eliminated a barrier, and it didn't cost, it didn't increase costs. And now the federal government is doing some small studies with a group of hospice programs to test this, to see if really, you know, they could implement this on a large scale without driving up costs, which would be a really positive development, because it's a huge barrier for people to sort of have to give up, you know, the possibility of treatment.
But I also think, too, the idea that they may have gotten comfortable and just gotten used to that level of pain or that level of that therapy, that they feel that that is their life hope. In other words, I got chemo today, I'm going to get another week. So they're thinking that chemo is that other week. So to have to say, if I give it up, then I don't have that other week. So, you know, the story A plus B equals C. Everybody is thinking, you know, in very short terms. So,
right.
If, you know, and then when we see people that say, when they get into, as you said, as they get into hospice and they start letting go of some of these therapies, that's where they start feeling that, you know what, okay, I do need this rest. I do need to let this go. And it's just a easier way of letting things go. Just periodically, you know, saying, okay, I'm not going to go for that today. I'm not going to do that next week, or I'm not going to do that next month. And it gives them a little bit more time to adjust to the concept, I think, of the idea that these therapies or treatments really aren't doing what I needed them to do, and that was a miracle for many, or for a lot of hope or extended time.
Right, and, you know, and in fact, they're doing the exact opposite. You know, they're taking up a lot of time. They're making me sick. You know, they're taking away time that I could be spending with my family, or, you know, in my garden, or whatever. So it really helps when people can experience the alternative and see that, it, you know, even if you let go, it doesn't mean you can actually reclaim other things in the process.
And also, too, I think when these extra therapies start coming up and family members start insisting you need to fight, you need to do this, and you really see that it's putting a huge financial burden on the family members that will be left behind, that's a time to, you know, you really need to be able to consciously make that decision. Am I really going to do this or not? Because finances can ruin families after patients have passed on, and that's just has been very difficult.
Yes, you know, and really on a large scale, when you look at, you know, kind of the resources that we spend, you know, on futile care at the end of life, it's huge, you know, and nobody really likes to talk about costs in end-of-life care, because, you know, you don't want to think, okay, we're going to just, you know, pull the plug on granny to save money. But we all know that healthcare costs are out of control, and if we keep letting things continue as they are, you know, it's going to bankrupt the country. So we really have to kind of think about how we spend the money, and, you know, and make choices that allow us to spend it wisely and not on absolutely futile, you know, chemotherapy in the last 24 hours of life kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, I can remember a client I had worked with, and she had just gotten checked into the hospital. I knew she was very, very close. And she said there were two things she wanted were donuts and tomatoes. And I had stopped and I brought them to her. And she ate half of one tomato, and don't you know, in comes a nurse behind me. And the nurse checks her blood, and then she says, oh, your sugar is going up too high. We have to give you some insulin now. And I'm thinking, can't you just leave her alone? Can't you just leave her alone? And, you know, she that was all she had wanted, and that was the last thing that she did eat, was her donuts and her tomatoes. But, you know, I guess when you're in that paradigm, we've got to run. It's sort of like when you're in a car, you have to act like you're in a car. If you're in a truck, you have a lot more room to spread out. You know, it's sort of like this concept, if you're in the hospital, those are the rules. This is what we do. There is no shaking and shifting of anything there. When you're in hospice, you have this. When you're in rehab, you have that. It's sort of, as soon as you walk through the doors, you know, this box of rules is just descended upon you, because they don't shift outside that paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Well,
let's see. And, you know, and they're not going to change their mind. I mean, that's just the way they are. A regular physician can't do that because they have to do the best that they can then. The other thing I want to touch on was the house. We always talk about people coming into the house because, you know, with hospice always comes and you have doctors, visiting nurses, you have hospice people coming in. Sometimes you have social workers coming in or psychologists or whatever, and it just seems like an ever-training, you know, all these people coming into your house that you don't even know who they are, and you're supposed to sit there and say or answer what they want, and then other family members that live in the house feel really uncomfortable with that process. And that is something that is very important to discuss.
It's important to discuss, and, you know, and it's also something that family members can take a little bit of control over. You know, you don't need to see everybody who wants to come in. If a hospice program wants to send a spiritual care person and that's not something that is of value to you or to your
mm-hmm.
loved one, you know, you can say no. You can say no to a volunteer. You can say no to lots of things. So it's not, again, you know, the idea behind good hospice care is to put some of the control back in the hands of patients and their families. And there is, you know, an array of services, and, you know, a social worker or somebody can explain what all there is. But you don't have to say yes to everything. And, you know, and if the patient lives on hospice care for a while, you don't have to say yes to everything immediately or yes to everything for as long as that patient is alive.
And I know a lot of hospice workers have even been friends of family members through the years, and they've had several of those family members in the same hospice care.
Yes, and a lot of people who are involved in hospice, either as, you know, as professionals or, you know, certainly as volunteers, have had their own hospice experiences and really came to the work really because of positive experiences that they had.
Absolutely. And so do you think that we're going to see changes in hospice going forward, or do you think it's going to be the good, bad, or the better? What do you think?
Great question. Well, we're certainly seeing changes. Medicare is changing the rules in some ways, as I mentioned earlier, that are good if it really does take away this either-or choice about treatment versus hospice care. They are also getting more restrictive about who can and can't be on hospice programs, so that's not a great thing. The other huge shift we're seeing nationally is the growth of hospice chains, hospice companies. Hospice began as a cause, really. You know, they were mostly all nonprofit organizations, and really a mission by dedicated people. And more, all the growth in hospice in the last 10 years, in fact, has been on the corporate side, for-profit hospice programs. And, you know, and there's some evidence that they cut corners in certain ways, you know, to boost the bottom line and other things. So, you know, we're going to have to see how this all plays out in the years ahead. And it's certainly going to be a huge issue because, you know, 76 million baby boomers are starting to turn 65.
Yeah, and I know that there's a lot of smaller places springing up that you really need to be very careful in choosing and have someone behind you to be able to help you make those decisions. You know, check out things, find out what other people have had, experiences they've had. And
yeah,
that's
a great point.
As you would anything, you know.
I know, you know, well, people, the last thing people think about when they get a hospice referral is to shop around for a good hospice program. You know,
right.
People are usually just, you know, not in that place physically and emotionally. And, you know, it's one of the things that we say in the book, you know, if many, many communities have multiple programs, so you really have a choice. And it really, really, really is worth the time to shop around. And in the book, we really offer some great advice on what to look for and how to ask those questions. You know, but the main thing, just to tell your listeners, is when you start asking the questions, see how the person on the other end of the phone or on the other side of a table answers your questions. And if they
right.
take the time that you need to get all your questions answered and to give you all the information you want, you know, that can be a good indication that it's a good program that's really going to spend time with you and your loved one. And if, you know, if you feel like the person is rushed, they're filling out forms,
right.
they're just kind of eager to get to the next appointment, that also, you know, that can be a red flag.
Yeah, I always tell people you should make at least 3, at a minimum, calls to the people to be able to screen them, because you will get an idea of their good, bad days, you know. Not everybody has a fabulous day, so you may catch them on that other one, but not everybody has always horrible days. You'll catch them on their good ones, you know,
right.
That whole thing, you know. So I call them 3 calls is the minimum, you know, and to be able to screen them, because you'll be able to say, you know, I didn't understand that question you told me last time. Can you explain it again? Or, I didn't write down that answer, and I don't understand it. What does that mean? And if you start asking these inquisitive questions with a little bit more of not instead of yes, no, and check on the box, you'll get a lot more insight into their knowledge and what they're able to provide and if that fits with you or not, and also if they're listening to you. Because if you say, I don't understand, can you explain it to me again? Are they listening, or are they just reading something off a paper? And that's so vitally important.
Yes, great advice.
Well, we have come to pretty much to the end of the show. I was wondering, Fran, if you could just share a little more. We have about 5 more minutes, a little more ideas that we may have not touched on about the stories in the book about the other clients. You could share a few of the stories. That'd be great.
Sure, I'd love to, because we met so many incredible people. I started to tell you earlier about the woman in her 90s who lived 14 months on hospice care. And, you know, she was really near death when she came into the program. And she lived, in the time that she was alive, she was able to, you know, get out of bed, go on short trips with her husband, go to the beach, spend time with family and friends. And she saw her oldest grandchild get married. And then this young woman, her oldest grandchild, got pregnant and had a baby. And
wow.
And this woman was able to hold her great-grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that as soon as the baby, you know, was 8 weeks old and had its, you know, vaccinations and was cleared to travel, the young mom brought her to this patient, and she held the baby and actually died just several hours later.
Wow.
And
that's important, and that's very important to see that life goes on, I think, don't you think? That's like something so simple that you just want to hear and see and validate.
Right, life goes on, and you've left you've left a really pretty good legacy there, you know.
Yeah.
And I am a journalist by background, as my co-author Sheila, also a journalist, and so we really came at this book through stories. Everybody in the book, we write about patient, real people. These are not made up people. We write about their, you know, we use their real names, and you know, all the people in the book are they're real people, and their lives are as complicated and beautiful as anybody else's.
And that's important, too, is to be able to say that the stories are so vitally important. People think that they don't leave anything, but, you know, oh, well, you know, I was the owner of a company, or I wrote a book, or, you know, all these big things. They think of those outside things instead of just saying and who they were. You know, and their heart and soul and their spirit, as we've always said on the show, is so vitally more important than those things you think in life are just tickers on the box, you know?
Right. Yeah, we write about a woman who was dying in hospice care. Actually, she'd been diagnosed with a cancer, and, you know, stage 4, and she immediately, at the time she was diagnosed, said, she was hearing all of her treatment options, and she said, I just want to go home. And that's what she did. She had grown children, but she was estranged. The whole family was estranged from one of the sons. And to see that son, and there was a reconciliation at the end.
And people do wait until the end, I think, a lot of times, too, to be able to do that, because they don't feel like they want to deal with it in their life, or they just didn't think that it meant that much to them until then.
Right. You know, but what a gift to have the opportunity to do that at the end.
Absolutely. So, Fran, could you give us some more information about your website, where to purchase your book, and any other information you have? That would be great.
Sure. Well, the book is called Changing the Way We Die, And it's available online at all major booksellers, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. It's available in lots of bookstores, but online is an easy way to go. And we have a website, www.changingthewaywedie.com. And you can get book information on the website as well. We also blog on these issues at psychologytoday.com, and there are links on our website to our blog.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. I know this is a topic that people don't really want to always have in daily conversations, but as we've always said that, you know, you don't know when you're going to need the information or when it may come upon you that you really have to help someone or yourself with this. So we always like to put this information out there ahead of time. So thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It was lovely talking with you.
Great. Thank you so much. If you'd like more information about Fran Smith and her book, Changing the Way We Die, Compassionate End-of-Life Care in the Hospice Movement, the link is on the bottom of today's show page. You just click right on her website link, and you'll be able to find more information out about Fran. And please do think about this, because even what we've always said is just pass it by your memory. Might not be next week, next month, next year. It could be 2 decades from now. But you could say, you know, I heard something about that before. I'm starting to understand. It's been passed by my brain one time. I think I may be able to look into this. And there's so much more information on the web. Check out Fran's website, and you'll be able to find out more questions and answers. And also, as she said, that she does have a blog, so you could also just check that out. Please do check out finding about end-of-life care. There's a lot of information. We've done many shows on this before on alternative health and wellness. You could just scroll through the past guests that were on the RSS feed. And also, if you need an advocate or a support to be able to say, you know, this something's going on with me. I don't know what it is. I'm kind of hitting the wall here. Or one of my family members, oh, my gosh, something happened. I need somebody to talk to. Well, I'm always here. The website is mypersonaladvocate and then the number 2.com. Or you can always send me a message directly through on today's show page. Thank you so much for being with us. And until tomorrow, it's been a pleasure. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher for Sedona Talk Radio, and have a great evening.